This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Living free.
Thanks to the Resident Frequency Radio crew for another great show, playing tracks and chatting with Collingwood artists. Welcome to Living Free, a one-hour show in which we highlight one of the many programs that assist in recovery from drugs, alcohol, gambling and food addictions. Our guests share their recovery story and highlight that shared experience saves lives. You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 on your AM radio or 3CR Digital, or maybe even live streaming on 3cr.org.au. My name's Michael. And I'm joined in the studio by my co-host, Mitch.
G'day, how are you?
Doing excellent. Nice. And today we've asked our guest, Steve, to share his experience of recovery from gambling addiction with the help of Gamblers Anonymous. But before we do that, I'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, traditional owners of the land from which 3CR transmits people-powered radio. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and acknowledge that this land was stolen and sovereignty was never ceded. And also, please note that the Living Free show may involve discussion of topics such as suicide, mental illness, self-harm and family violence. So please consider your well-being and that of others while listening. This is a special show today with the subscriber drive that's on, and we'll be asking people who are listening to renew your membership. And if you haven't got a membership, then to take out a membership, and we'll give you the numbers to do that on throughout the show.
Yeah, so, if you don't, you really should, and we'll be telling you why today.
That's exactly right. That's exactly what we'll be doing in the kindest, gentlest way we can.
Oh, yeah.
So welcome, Steve. Welcome to the show. It's great you could join us in the studio. And we like to start the show by asking our guests to tell us a bit about their upbringing or their childhood. So what was it like to grow up as yourself?
Look, to be frank, it was, for all intent and purposes, it was a very happy childhood for me. It came from a great family, great mum and dad, siblings. And, looking from the outside, you'd be described as describe myself as a normal kid from a normal family. But basically where things sort of took a turn for me was from a very early age, I was just drawn, to horse punting. And my dad was a once-a-week horse punter, basically a hobby for him, but with myself. So, I was just instantly attracted to everything about, the sport itself, just from the colours of the silks that the jockeys wore and the horses and, the smell of the grass from the race. I just loved it from day one. And initially it was just the whole, every aspect of the industry. And then that, again, changed radically when I placed my first bet, so...
Do you remember the first kind of time you mentioned the smell and the excitement around it? Do you remember the first time you were made aware of your dad being into the horses?
Yeah, look, it was just growing up. It was, we lived, fairly close to a TAB, and dad would place his bets on a Saturday, and other dads in the area did as well. So it was quite normal as part of our lives, and they on a Saturday it was football. Putting a quaddy on and reading the Herald Sun. So it was just, to me, just a normal part of life.
Mm. And how were the actual bets themselves kind of placed? Was it obviously an in-person kind of thing, or?
So initially, back then, obviously being quite young, I would badger Dad to put bets on me, and initially it was like, no, go away. And recall quite vividly being at a racetrack, and it was a major race, and everyone was talking about the favourite that was going to win, and I was just I was at that point really drawn to looking at the horses and studying the jockeys and the horses, and I liked this other horse, and I badgered Dad to put some money on something that apparently had no chance, and it got up and won. So and that from that point onwards, everything's changed drastically, because for me at that such a young age, I was 9 years old, I was right and everyone was wrong. Mm. And I was all of a sudden the expert, and I knew more than everyone, and percent to chase that feeling, you know, for many, many years after.
That's that feeling of, yeah, a win, which can be so euphoric, especially at such a young age. Do you remember the feelings around a specific loss or a loss that stood out that your dad kind of had that you remember?
Not with Dad, because it was all very controlled with him. Like, that was... Dad was very different to me in that he would, that was his hobby, and we'd go, and then he had a set amount of money, which we, you know, and he'd bet conservatively, and that was it. And when that, you know, we'd go home, and, you know, and Mum controlled the purse strings anyway. So,
yeah.
And that to me, even at an early age, that was, I found that incredibly frustrating, because it'd be like, well, no, if you've lost that, go to the bank and get more money. We keep, you know, even at such an early age, but Dad's like, no, that's it. That's, you know, and, also, that changed dramatically as well, because shortly after that, there was a period where we were going to the races quite regularly, and then Dad started renovating the house, and that was it. It was, no, there's no races on a Saturday. We're pulling down floorboards and pulling out floorboards and painting, and I was just horrified that instead of going to the race, leading this, you know, exciting life, I was going to be doing manual labour for the next, because those renovations took many, many years. So, yeah, that wasn't a happy period in my life.
bit of a switch up there.
Yeah.
I did ask earlier, but were you a risk taker in other areas of your life?
No, absolutely not. And I've never been asked that. And no, very conservative. So very out of the, for me, very left field. I think that bet, because, you know, when that horse won, I think, you know, I think I'd won, you know, probably something would have taken Dad a month or two in wages to earn. And he worked, you know, in a factory, so to me it was like, I've, you know, it was very euphoric, but it's like, I've got the secret in life, you know, I'm just gonna pick all these amazing outsiders and just, you know, do it easy. So yeah
that feeling sticks with you. You mentioned that, you know, things kind of changed when you put your first bet on yourself.
Yeah, it was so that was, and bearing in mind, this is, we're talking in the early 80s, things were very different back then. So I remember that I was terrified, thinking they're not going to accept my bet, because I think I was about 12 years old. And back then, when I was 12, I looked like I was 10, but, you know, the person at the venue took my bet. So I just started, and that was, you know, okay. And then where things, yeah, I'll never forget, when I turned 15, I got a job, and I remember losing my first wages. Like, it was only 3 hours, I remember losing it the next day in a venue, in a TAB, and I was just absolutely devastated. And what made it worse was, you know, in my mind I said, I'm going to go back, I'm going to win what I lost, because I worked so hard for that money, and then I'm never going to bet again. And as it turned out, I did go back, and at one point I did win back the wages that I'd lost, but then I'll just try and win some more, and then, yeah, that cycle just repeated endlessly for many years.
Yeah, and, you know, did the memory of your, you know, that win that you had as a 9-year-old and the wins that you had, did that kind of propel you into continuing to bet in that period?
Yeah. Absolutely. And looking back now, I think too, because it correlated with my 10 years, you know, very, for me anyway, it was very awkward years. So I was about, you know, I was quite, you know, matured later in life than a lot of my friends and peers at school. And I think to me, gambling was just a perfect escape for me from reality, because, you know, you didn't have to think. You would just, you know, whether you be at a racetrack or, you know, in a TAB, reality was suspended for that time that you were there. And I think the older I got, the more that addiction grew.
And you mentioned your dad's friends were betting as well. Were your mates betting at the time, or was that just a thing that you did?
Look, there were a couple. We had a group that, you know, friends my age, but again, they were like similar to my dad, where they would, I remember on Saturdays we'd go as a group, but they would, you know, they had their limits. They had, and I'd go for 2 hours and then they'd go home. Win, lose, or draw, they'd go home. And I'd be looking and thinking, why are you going? You know what I mean? And so I knew then I was different. And I knew then, obviously, that I had clearly had a problem, because I just couldn't do what other people could do. They could control it, and to them, they could take it or leave it. And I couldn't. If I was there, particularly, you know, Saturdays were the big days, I had to be there for as long as the money would last.
Yeah. How did you kind of deal with the losses at the time when you did experience them? They obviously sounded, you know, kind of devastating in context.
Yeah, it was really tough because, you know, at the time I worked in my teen years and I worked hard. And you would, it was just demoralising, you know, to work hard for your wages. You know, I worked in, you know, fast food restaurants and, you know, cleaning grease and, you know, flipping burgers, mopping floors, and then, you know, very hard to earn, but, you know, you lose it in 20 minutes. So it's just demoralising knowing that, you know, particularly, and sometimes it'd be a week's full of, you know, school holidays, you're working most days, and you've just, you know, lost a week's wages in a couple of hours. Is just absolutely demoralising.
How much time do we have before
Plenty. We got, so what, were your parents overseeing this? Was there sort of any sort of adult interaction with
this?
Yeah,
there was. So Dad obviously became quite concerned. And then, yeah, I think, to be frank, with the home renovations, that was a way I've looked to try and get me away. But then that just – and Mum was horrified. Mum said at the start to Dad, you know, he shouldn't be going to racetracks. I remember there being arguments over that. And, you know, I think Dad obviously realised that over time. And so it just – I went underground, basically. It's my secret. And, yeah, no, I won't, you know, say, yeah, I'm going to play footy or I'm going to do this. But I was gambling, so –
Well, we might take a break.
3CR is radical radio.
Through our on-air content and community structure, we promote real change for workers' rights, gender equality, environmental action, disability justice, and on racism and First Nations sovereignty.
Do you want to be part of real radical change?
We need you to subscribe. It's just $40 concession, $80 waged, $150 for a band or organisation, and $300 solidarity.
Call 03-9419-8377. That's 9419-8377. Or subscribe online at 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
You're listening to Living Free on 3CR Community Radio, 855 on the AM radio or 3CR on digital radio or maybe even live streaming on 3cr.org.au. If you'd like to listen to one of our many podcasts, then you can find us on your preferred podcast platform or just search for 3CR Living Free and check out the website. Or you can contact us by phone on 94198377 or email. Today we're talking to Steve about his recovery from gambling addiction through Gamblers Anonymous. And before the break, you sort of talked about your introduction to gambling. Maybe we'll move forward a bit in time and just tell us a bit about, you know, when it got out of control, what started to happen in your life and your family's lives.
I think, where it definitely started to really get out of control. So I'm still almost 10 years. So in the final year of high school, back then it was called HSC, we... You know, unfortunately for me, at the school that I went to at the time, there was a TAB across the road. So I spent a lot of time, instead of studying, if I wasn't across the road gambling, I was in the library reading form guides, et cetera. So I had a really profound effect on my schooling. And then when I started working full time, it was essentially my life just became... My work was to service my gambling addiction. So and then because of that, obviously, and the secrecy as well. So, you know, initially lying to my parents and to my siblings and, you know, and then to not get caught, I would ride my bike, you know, 10 kilometres to hopefully, you know, where I couldn't be found or caught. And that just continued on into my adult years where, I would secretly, you know, go to venues hoping that... you know, there wouldn't be people there that knew, because I was a very closet gambler, very ashamed of my addiction. And but it just, as I got older, so probably up until about the age of 26, it was kind of manageable, but then it really started to spiral after the bets started getting bigger. And so probably from about the ages of 26 to 30, not a happy period. But then for me, the lowest point was probably from the age of 30 to 36, basically, was horrific. By that point, I was so terrified of people finding out that, you know, I've moved from where I was living, so I could just, you know, basically gamble, no one would know. and just I just basically work and then and gamble, and it was just a horrific lifestyle, to be frank. So
And when the bets started getting bigger around 26, do you remember kind of what triggered that? Was it something that like you just went all in around that time, or
funnily enough, I had a friend who was a gambler as well, and we were in a TAB together, and he said, no, because I was quite a small game, even at that point, quite a small, my bets were quite small. He said, no, if you want to win big, you have to bet big. Mm. So,
famously,
that, yeah,
good friend.
And that just seemed to resonate with me. Of course, yes.
Of course.
Because my problem was I was never going to win big because I wasn't betting big. So, yeah, they just got bigger and bigger, unfortunately.
Okay.
Did you do any other sort of gambling? Was it just always horse racing?
It was predominantly horse racing. When I say horse racing, say in a TAB, horse racing during the day, and then at night you'd have gambling. So you'd have greyhound racing and
sport of kings,
mm-hmm. which I absolutely detested because it was over. It was the race would be over in a flash. But I was addicted, so I would when the horse racing finished, I'd just if I had money, I'd still continue on to the greyhounds and the harness racing.
Wow.
Oh, and look, when the casino came out, gave that a try, but it was really bizarre because I just remember walking through and I don't know how you can possibly win. And having, grown up playing a few card games, I'd tried the poker tables and had some wins and had some big wins and some little wins, but then thought, no, this is, you can't win here. So
just didn't hit the same.
Yeah, I didn't get the same high for some reason. Mm. It just didn't. Went back to the horses.
What did it feel like when you were actually watching the races themselves? Like,
that's a great question. So even before the adrenaline of getting on, because again, being in a addicted gambler, I wouldn't study the form guide. And then, wait 20 minutes. And then it was literally, because back then it was races every 3. So it was just a mad rush just to get on. So that adrenaline to make that bet. And then there'd be an adrenaline surge when the barriers open. And then if your horse was in a winning position, that was a nut. That was just next level euphoria. So, to me, if your horse was good, had kicked clear in the straight, was about to swamp it down the outside and win, there was no more euphoric feeling than that to mm-hmm. me. So there was a range of emotions.
Mm-hmm. The language is interesting. Like I'm watching you shake your hand and go, get on, but it's the same language as narcotics.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Like get on.
Get on.
When you get on. And it's just...
Same reaction.
Yeah, same reaction as well. It's just really interesting to listen to.
Yeah. Absolutely. The bets got bigger and potentially out of control. And then what led you to seeking help when you did?
I just pretty much exhausted all avenues in terms of, because I was a closet gambler, I was too embarrassed to ask people for money. There was a certain inner circle friends that I would try and borrow money off, but it was, and the biggest victim, unfortunately, was my mother, who... when things got really bad and the bills absolutely had to get paid, I would hit her up in secret. And I just remember the last time I borrowed, and I was devastated. And, she was on a pension by then, and of course she lent me the money, and I said to her, I promise, Mum, this is the last time. And
famous words of an addict. Absolutely famous words of an addict, is that I won't be doing this again.
Yeah, and so that was the last time, and then, how did it kind of develop from there?
Yeah, look, so I knew, so basically I did have a stint at my early 20s, but the issue I had back then, funnily enough, when I went there it worked, but probably the biggest issue I had there was I walked into a room, so I was 20, in my early 20s, around 22, and everyone else in the room was 30 plus, some in their 50s, 60s, they'd lost houses, their wives had divorced them, one person had been in jail. Mm. I thought, well, I'm not as, so I looked at the differences and not the similarities, and I was, I just lose my paycheck every fortnight, so I'm not as bad as them. And so even though the time that I was there, which is roughly 9 months, I'd actually stopped gambling, doing all the wrong things, I still... reading form guides, watching races, but I actually stopped gambling for the first time in my life. I think part of me wasn't ready to completely surrender. So I walked away for 14 years and then, you know, and did try psychiatrist, psychologist, you know, hypnotherapy, none of those things worked. And then it came to that point where I'd pretty much hit my rock bottom and I knew where I had to go and what I needed to do. So that was returning to the fellowship.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Because I guess, you know, when people start going to meetings initially, they hear something that they didn't expect in someone else's story that reminds them of, you know, their own story, and maybe that breakthrough happens. But yeah, I guess that didn't happen for you initially.
I did. Like I said, I did relate, but I just looked at the differences more. It was like, that'll never happen to me. Not, you know, and again, lost 3 hours. No, that'll never happen to me. You know, what? No, that'll never happen to me. And, you know, and the irony was with the losing the houses, when it got to the point of coming back, I didn't have a house because I was never in a position to buy a house because I was always broke. Well, not broke, just heavily in debt.
Yeah.
So I became those people in the room.
So what does rock bottom look like?
Rock bottom to me was, you know, being in, you know, burning yet another relationship through lies and deceit and living in secrecy in terms of being a closet, and you know, lying, constantly lying, and, you know, putting on that false front to family, going to family functions, and, you know, you've just lost again, you've lost a month's wages in, you know, 2 hours, and you have to go to a party and pretend everything's okay. That was just excruciating. And just, you know, mental and physical health was absolutely completely shot. Raging depression for many, many years, untreated. And just at the lowest point where, you know, it was, I felt myself sort of, you know, metaphorically felt like I was walking towards the end of a cliff, and the edge wasn't far away. So,
can I just ask you a little bit as well, just going back to when you briefly stopped gambling for a little while, how did you feel in that period of time? Did you feel like a clarity at all, or?
Yeah, it was really bizarre. It was a really strange feeling to not lose your pay and having money for normal things. It was quite enjoyable, but you know, at the time, the trade-off in terms of, you know, no more euphoria with gambling as to, you know, being able to buy your lunch and, you know, go out for dinner and stuff, the trade-off wasn't to me enough.
Absolutely, yeah, you get them. Because the thing that kills us is inside, I reckon. It's the way I feel about me, based on the behaviour. I'm acting against my own moral compass when I'm acting in addiction.
Yeah.
Like, I'm powerless over the... Like, even though I know it's wrong, I'm doing it.
Yeah.
And so I've got to do something. Like, I either do denial on a level that's amazingly impressive.
Yeah.
To go, I've got to do something, so I'm being completely dishonest with the people around me, and I'm even lying to myself to tell me that's okay. And then eventually I can't believe my own lies.
Yeah.
And so then I go, it doesn't look like there's a way out, because I can't physically stop myself from doing it, and I know it's wrong, and every relationship around me is false as well.
It's not sustainable.
It's not sustainable. So I start doubting my you know, whether I want to live or die. Well, that was my experience with addiction. Is that I'm going, I don't know how I'm going to do this, because it's not going to stop.
Yeah.
There's no good end coming here. There's no light at the end of the tunnel. There's nothing.
No.
And rock bottom sort of looks like there's no hope.
Absolutely.
I'm in this position of complete hopelessness, which is a really good place to be. Like, you know, desperate is nice, but hopeless is better, is the way I've heard it. And because from there, there's, you know, when I get shown some hope, that's, whoa. So did you, so when you went back to AA, oh, sorry, to GA, did you get this this feeling of hope?
Absolutely. I'll never forget my first meeting back. And for the entire I cried for the entire meeting while other people were sharing their own therapies, but particularly with my own therapy. And it was just a combination of all the pain. I'd find it's just all coming out from the last, you know, 20 years of the lies, the deceit, the gambling. It all come out, but it was cries of anguish, but also cries of crying because of relief. I was so relieved to finally, I was back with like-minded people, and I knew this time, forget about the differences. This is where you absolutely need to be. It doesn't, and it was just an amazing experience. It was very polarizing in, you know, different emotional feelings, obviously, but I knew, and even driving to the meeting, I knew I had this sense of positivity for the first time in my life. I was going somewhere where I knew I was going to get help. I just knew, and it all came out in that meeting.
Cool. We might take another break and we'll come back and we'll talk about what life looks like now after this.
3CR gives space to voices excluded from mainstream media, to people who want to be heard.
And to help keep 3CR on the air, you need to donate and subscribe.
Call 9419 8377 or online at 3cr.org.au.
Welcome back. You're listening to Living Free on 3CR, 855 on AM radio, digital radio, and live streaming on 3cr.org.au. We're encouraging you to, if you're not a subscriber, then to become a subscriber of 3CR Community Radio, or if you are currently a subscriber, then to renew your subscription. We would encourage you to, if you're going to be a subscriber, that you might consider selecting auto-renew for your subscription so that your membership keeps rolling on every year, because we love the security of knowing we have your support year in, year out. And our 3CR is heading into its 50th year of broadcasting, and the ongoing subscriptions are vital to the station. They are as vital to the station today as they have been for all the years that they've been running. If you're a regular listener to this program, we would encourage you to jump on board. And so we can hear more voices of people. The program is premises that shared experiences save lives, and it allows the 3CR to continue to support this program and have people come on and tell their stories of hopelessness, as where we sort of got to just before the break. We get into people with addiction get to a state of complete hopelessness and then find something that actually gives them a reason to live and a way of living. And we love to hear the stories of recovery rather than just the stories of doom and gloom. So today we've got Steve in the studio, and he's sharing about his recovery from gambling addiction through Gamblers Anonymous.
Yeah, and that hopelessness as well, which can actually be a beautiful thing.
Yeah, it's as I said, it's a great place to start from. You've got to start from somewhere, and that's been my experience in addiction, is that I needed to have it all beaten out of me. My complete belief that I've got this covered, that I'm going to be able to manage my life, needs to be beaten out of me so that I can make a decision that maybe I'll try something different. Because my experience is that actually when things get tough, I try harder and I try harder and I try harder. And actually, I don't try different. I do the same thing harder and harder, apply more willpower to it, and it gets worse and worse results. Mm. And I still go there again. So anyway, that's not about me. So Steve, what you reintroduced yourself to Gamblers Anonymous, and what happened? What happened next, and what does it look like now?
So early days, it was very much by stealth. And just to be clear, going back to GA, I had no long term plans of being a long term member. For me, in my mind, it was still a financial problem. I just thought, well, I just need to, get a bit of money back behind me and get some money in the bank and be able to because at that point I had money for nothing. I was barely paying the bills, so it wasn't a long-term plan for me. So my grand plan was to go to GA and just basically steady the ship and then get a few months of time off and then go out and gamble again. But as they say, if you get in there to meetings long enough, the program gets you, and it got me, thank God. I had a very fortunate. I had a very good sponsor who he was also in AA as well. So he was, as you say, by the book. So he was, and early days, I was basically doing recovery on my own terms, which meant rocking up to meetings late, sometimes not going to a meeting once a week, fairly blasé. And I'll never forget, he gave me a really good talking to one night, and you can go in two directions here, and make your choice. So I decided at that point, okay, well, doing things on my terms just didn't work. Clearly, I knew the direction I had to. So I just basically did what I followed the program and I followed the steps. And I went to multiple meetings, so up to three meetings a week for the first few years. Service work, chairing meetings, treasurer, etc. Getting really involved. And it just, like I said, the program got me. And then I had a penny drop moments like, oh, I'm here for life. But more importantly, I wanted to be there, and I knew that it's not like a a job where, you know, you need to do this to earn a wage. It was, this is, no, if I want to recover and, you know, because it wasn't for me and still isn't just about not gambling. It's about, okay, I needed to make significant changes in my life to become happy and to, you know, live a relatively normal life.
And how long did it take for that penny drop moment to kind of happen?
Probably about 6 months in on my second stint. Okay. So,
interesting, yeah, because I guess at first the plan was to, you know, go for a couple months and then you'd go back to gambling. But at that point you must have, you know, been invested enough to keep going and then it happened for you.
Absolutely, yeah.
Can I ask about your sponsor? So how did your sponsor connect with you? What kind of stuck out about, you know, the relationship that you had with your sponsor?
We just, after a meeting, grabbing a cup of coffee, and we just started talking and related to each other, and the connection was pretty clear. And there was no formal request on my behalf or his. And then I turned around and I said, I guess you're my sponsor. And he goes, I guess I am. And so it's just one of those things that was meant to be.
Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? It's the most important relationship I'm going to have with somebody in recovery. You know, I have a partner who doesn't understand anything about why she hasn't seen me drink. And I know I'm in recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, but she hasn't seen my addiction play out. And so she doesn't understand why I still go. We're sort of laughing about this earlier, but you know, she doesn't know, you're still going there. You haven't had a drink for 17 years. But what my sponsor knows everything about me. Like through the process of I've owned my own behaviour, and one of the steps is that that I share that, you know, I admit to God, to myself, and to another human being the exact nature of the things that I've, the wrongs that I've done in my life, and that person knows me more on a more personal level than anybody else. That's my experience of my sponsor, and I've entrusted them with something. And as sponsoring other people, what happens is that other people do that for me, and it keeps me accountable. It's a really bizarre relationship. I don't have it in any other aspect of my life, you know. But if I watch business, people who are good in business have mentors. Yeah. Like no one trusts their own thinking enough 100% that they go, oh yeah, like the best minds of the world share their thinking with other people to check that their thinking is okay. Because anybody who thinks that their thinking is 100% right all the time is a bit delusional.
Right, right. Or business, or even, you know, performers, stand-up comedians, the only way to actually test your material is to get that feedback, right?
Yeah, that's right. And so you get this opportunity and you give them permission to tell you the truth as they see it. And they may not be right, but you at least I know for me, I don't argue with my sponsor. Mm. Like if he tells me something, I go, yeah, cool. Yeah. I've asked him for help, and it's one of the few times, like, I'll ask a lot of people for help, but usually I then argue with them about the help they're offering, and he offers me help, and I go, yeah, I'll trust him on that.
Yeah. That's a safe bet.
So that's a really good important. So where really, I think, really sunk in for me was when I went through the fourth and fifth step with my sponsor and sharing the most, so basically you're listing the things, multiple things over your life that you've done wrong and things that you agree and all that, and sharing that with somebody else was huge for me, because again it was an enormous relief. And I'll never forget, and I said, and I had pages, I'm a prolific writer, and I had pages and pages and pages of things, and it took about 6 hours, and I remember this sense of relief when we finished, and I said, what do I do with these now? And he goes, whatever you want, you can keep what you can burn. And I burnt them, and I remember, you know, burning and watching the ashes, and I said, it was a really cathartic experience for me. So really important part of my recovery.
Yeah, a meaningful moment for sure. Just from relationships in the program to relationships out of the program, you mentioned your mum before. How did your relationship with your mum and with your parents change after you were in the program?
Yeah, just dramatically. It's hard for me to talk about this and not get emotional, particularly when it comes to my mum, because, because I could see her, it was killing her. My addiction was killing her, and she was powerless to help me, and she knew that, and I knew that. But now she looks at me differently. And she doesn't get the program. My dad doesn't get the program, but she knows I'm different, and she knows that what I'm saying is the truth, and that's probably the best aspect of my, you know, I've had some wonderful, wonderful things happen in my recovery. My life's turned completely around, but to have that relationship with my mother now and knowing that she knows that I'm okay, it's really quite emotional.
It creates, our addictions create this disconnection with the people we love. Like the problem is that I tell you that I love you, and then my actions show you that I don't. And so I have this huge gulf between my intentions and my actions, and I need to see something to fill the gap, that the guilt that comes with that. Yeah. But the people closest to us get burnt the most,
yeah,
because they're closest. And the program gives us this opportunity to rebuild bridges that haven't really burnt with them. Like, they, if they're separated from us, they've chosen the most difficult decision in their life, is they've gone, I can't be there anymore.
Yeah.
And I, as a parent myself, I look at that and go, I can't imagine having to do that with my own kids, to go actually to make that decision, I can't be show up anymore because they hurt me too much.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, but they're still there.
Yeah. Yeah, those bridges aren't burnt. The things you wrote were burnt. You know, you burnt those yourself.
Absolutely.
But yeah, and it sounds like that unspoken acknowledgement from your mum as well. Where,
yeah, and with my dad, interestingly, I remember one night Dad was really distressed because I was, I think I was in my early 30s, still renting, barely paying, and he said, you know, you should have a house, Benny, you should be married, gambling's just destroyed your life and you've made a mess. And he wasn't being condescending, or he wasn't trying to be mean-spirited. He was basically telling the truth, and I absolutely lost it, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'll never feel, I stood up and I said, you know, this is all your fault, you're the one. You took me to a racetrack. This is all on you. And the look, and then I there was a door nearby, which I punched and, you know, smashed that to smithereens. And the look on his face, I'll never forget. And I just had such an enormous sense of regret. And
no, you're right.
Sorry, get emotional. But then in recovery, you know, having, you know, my relationship with my father now is, Dad, it wasn't your fault.
Yeah. It's amazing, isn't it? And when you write a fourth step, we can see how unforgiving we are, because, you know, I can show you by how long my resentment list is and how far it goes back. You know, I go, I'm holding stuff against those people from, you know, 40 years ago, and our parents and then the people around us are so forgiving, and like, then they just want to love us, and they just want us to be available to love, but I didn't come to a 12-step fellowship to get that. I come here to stop the behaviour that I was doing, that was driving me insane and driving me, you know, financially and all this other stuff. But what happens is I build a life up through doing the 12 steps of 12-step fellowship, and I rebuild a life that is completely nothing to do with the addiction that I had, and I get joy out of things that are completely different. You know, you're not sitting here about the crying about the money that you made back.
No.
You know, the financial stuff. We're sitting there talking about the relationships, which is really the thing that killed us, was our lack of relationship. Absolutely. With the people around us, and that our addiction was destroying.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of the time I hear about, you know, the benefits from doing the program in the ways that you don't expect. You know, like you said, you know, your intentions in actually getting involved in the first place, that might serve you, but, yeah, it almost impacts many different aspects of your life.
Yeah, it's everything.
That's a great point. Yeah, I find recovery, there's so many very welcome surprises. Like, oh, I didn't expect this in recovery, and it's things that you never think of, and things that you didn't think were important to you really are now. And it's, that to me is never ending recovery now, and it's it just never ceases to amaze me.
Yeah. So unless you've got another question, Michael, I guess active recovery day to day, what is that kind of, or week to week, what does that kind of look like for you today?
Still, weekly meetings, obviously now. That's a must. I go to two different fellowships, two different groups. So just to maintain those relationships, but also to give a bit back. That's the really important aspect now of my recovery. It's because, you know, as I say, in the first few years, it's all about you, and it is. But now it's to give back. So service work, and, you know, helping people, you know, who you can in the fellowship. You know, by all intents and purposes, you know, normal life, married now, kids, you know, dealing with it, you know, as we say in the fellowship, you know, normal people problems, which is different class of problems, which I actually take great pride in, because it's so nice to be worrying about, you know, bills and incidentals and stuff, rather than, you know, the issues that you had in addiction in terms of your relationships that you destroyed. And so, yeah, different class of problems that, you know, I'm very happy to have today, which I didn't have when I was in action.
Nice.
Awesome, yeah. So I think that the language was that they offered me a life beyond my wildest dreams. And the only thing that's changed is my dreams. And you know, what I dream is what I needed is just completely different to what I thought I needed.
Yeah.
And so those aha moments I have in life, I go, oh, that's available too.
Yeah.
It's all about the fact, oh, I didn't know. I wouldn't have even thought about it. And yeah, that's awesome to hear your story. I really appreciate you coming in and sharing with us today. Like, it's a great message of hope to, if you've got a gambling problem, or, you know, if you've got a gambling problem and you want to find out more about Gamblers Anonymous, you can phone them on 96966108 or go online to gaaustralia.org.au. And yeah, I'd like to thank Steve for coming in. He's got a run off and got some stuff on this afternoon, and we'll wrap up the show after the song. But thanks very much for coming in and sharing your experience today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming in. Nice to meet
you. You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.